Today's Teisho is on case 37 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 37 is entitled Banzan's Three Worlds, No Dharma. Engo's introduction. The spirit which moves like lightning, you fail to follow. When the bolt descends from the blue, you have no time to cover your ears. The scarlet banner flutters over the master's head. The two-edged sword is being brandished behind the student's neck. Unless your eyes are sharp and your hands move quickly, how can you cope with the situation? One will lower his head and ponder, following the delusive ways of thought. Don't you know that countless skulls are haunted by ghosts? I want to ask you, without falling into the delusive ways of thinking, and without halting irresolutely, how can you respond to the teacher's words? See the following. Banzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds, there is no Dharma. Where could you find the mind? Secho's verse, three worlds, no Dharma. Where could you find the mind? White clouds crowd the heavens. The streams draw music from the harp, tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought the autumn's waters deep. So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice Zen this morning and for sitting so deeply. This is a wonderful opportunity to deepen our practice by sitting for longer periods, right? Longer period of sitting, half a day, really. It's a wonderful chance to enter deep samadhi and stay in deep samadhi. So transformative. And this koan is sort of asking, what's so transformative about it, right? What's so transformative about it? So, you know, I was reading an article the other day about the beginning of the carbon economy that we live in. And it was talking about how, you know, people discovered oil, learned they could take the oil and turn it into gasoline. And then basically, once they had...
Oh, thank you so much.
Once they had gasoline, they could invent automobiles and so on. And it was talking about how difficult it's going to be to shift from, you know, the gasoline economy, right, to the alternative economy, and that it's not at all easy. And places like the United States and places like China are trying very hard to do this, but actually it seems very difficult, right? When you realize, you know, just how, especially here in New Jersey, you know, when I lived in Seattle, I've lived in a number of places. When I lived in Baltimore as a kid, you know, my father drove a car to work, but we could get on the bus and go almost anywhere. And in Seattle, there's a wonderful bus system. You know, you can pretty much get anywhere. It can take a little time, but the bus system is really wonderful. I didn't own a car in Seattle, and I loved just being able to, you know, walk outside my apartment, go three blocks, catch a bus, be downtown, and then after I was downtown, catch another bus and go up to Capitol Hill, meet some friends for a movie. You know, that was just wonderful. So, you know, coming out here to New Jersey, it was necessary to get a car, and I just realized, you know, everything is, this is a total car culture. You know, it's just totally about cars. And it's going to be so difficult, right, to shift to a non-carbon-based transportation system. We've invested so much, right? And anyway, this article was kind of discouraging. It was saying, you know, it's going to be really hard to make this change. I was listening on NPR yesterday to a story about the Chinese government is trying to get everybody to shift from coal to natural gas in Mongolia. And the reporter went to this farm in Mongolia where this woman used to heat her house with coal. She actually would have like a little coal pile behind her house, and she'd bring the coal in, and there was a coal-fired stove, and she would put the, you know, put the coal in there and light it, and of course that would vent out the chimney and black smoke, right? And now the government wants her to use natural gas, and they've installed a natural gas stove in her house, a heater in her house. But, you know, she says it's so much more expensive than the coal. And she said she doesn't know that she can afford it. And you think, oh, this is all so difficult. And it's not just these cultural arrangements, right? I mean, we all feel sometimes really locked in, like change is impossible, right? And then when change does come, it's so difficult to adapt, right? It's so difficult to adapt to change when it does happen, right? And if you have had in the last, say, 6 months, had like a change in your life, you know, it can feel very difficult to adapt. So my wife, for example, you know, had a job managing these greenhouses. And last year, they all closed down. And I definitely know she had a hard time adjusting to that, right? It was that because, you know, basically every day, or actually sometimes 6 days a week, she would get up and she would go to her greenhouses. And she would spend anywhere from 4 to 8 hours there 6 days a week. And, you know, she had all her equipment in the back of her car, and she had her day, you know, she'd get to the greenhouse and she had lists of plants she had to clone, and, you know, she knew what she had to do for the day. And suddenly that was all gone, just like suddenly, like, you know, as you remember in March, they just basically closed Rutgers down around spring break. And the county colleges did the same thing. And she got an email and said, please don't come in. And, you know, basically we'll take care of the plants. And, you know, she just got up and it's like, now what do I do? And I think we feel it's very, you know, it's in a situation like that, it can be very painful, actually, because we cultivate these habits, right? We cultivate these habits, and the more we repeat them, the more real they seem and the more familiar they seem, right? And in Buddhism, there's actually a term for this. It's vasana, habit energy. And vasana are very, very important concept in Buddhism. This idea that, you know, we create these energy patterns or these energy habits that define our reality, and it's the repetition that makes the feeling of reality. You know, so I know it was difficult for Barbara to suddenly get up and not have to jump in her car and think about what plants she had to clone for the day, and she had to order, you know, different kinds of fertilizer and vermiculite and pick up the orders. All of that was gone. And I think it felt very unnerving, right? When I was in intermediate school, there was a period when I really suffered a lot. You know, for me, elementary school was a pretty pleasant experience. I actually liked going to school, But when I went to the intermediate school where I lived in Virginia, near the Naval Weapons Station in Yorktown, it was a completely different situation. You know, I still had a few friends from elementary school, but most of my classmates were unfamiliar, and they all seemed to know each other, and it was very difficult for me to adjust to like the new rhythms. And I remember being very unhappy. You know, and one day I actually played hooky. I told my mother goodbye. I'm going to school, and then I didn't get on the bus, and I just hung around out by myself. And I felt so. I had imagined I would feel like liberated. I had imagined that this would feel fantastic, you know. But actually, I felt terrible. I felt maybe if I had been a different kind of kid, you know, I would have had a good time. But I felt not just guilty for skipping school, but I felt like uneasy. You know, it's like I could think right now they'd be doing this, and right now they'd be doing this, and it's you know, right now they'd be eating lunch, and I couldn't enjoy the spontaneity of my situation because, you know, those energy habits had already become very familiar and very reassuring. And the irony is that when I was in school, a lot of the time I was deadly bored, right? It was just like, all I could do was think of, let me out of here, right? I can remember, especially in the afternoon, just thinking, oh, it's only 3 o'clock. How can I stand being here? But when I was away, you know, the absence of those patterned repetitions was very unnerving and left me with a feeling of emptiness or uneasiness. It's like, you know, this lack of structure was frightening to me. So, you know, this is a very important element in our lives. You know, we create our world by repetition, right? And the more we do things, the more real they become. And this is a little bit like sesshin, right? When you come to sesshin, you know, if you haven't ever come to sesshin before, and if you're thinking about it, we have one coming up. I hope you'll give it a try. You know, when you first get to sesshin, it's kind of a jolt, you know, because for one thing, you're getting up at 4:30 in the morning, and you have to be in the zendo by 5, and that in itself is a shock if you're used to getting up later, right? You know, maybe you're the kind of person who likes to get up around 7, and you know, you get up at 7 and you have a ritual. You know, you get up at 7 and you think, oh my gosh, it's 7 o'clock, I've got to get up. You go downstairs, you know, maybe you make some coffee, you start the coffee, you know, you sit down, you turn on the radio, you listen to NPR, maybe you have a piece of toast while you're waiting. And every day it might be like that, right? You know, maybe one day it's an orange or a piece of banana instead of the toast, and you know, that feels real. The more you do that, the more real it feels, the more comfortable you are. Even if you're bored, you know, it feels real, right? So then you come to sesshin, and suddenly you have to get up at 4:30 in the morning and be in the zendo by 5. And it's all it's not just uncomfortable or disorienting. There's something that might make you uneasy. If you think about it, vaguely uneasy about being on this different schedule. And, you know, then we do meditation, we recite sutras until 6, we have a bathroom break, we do meditation until 7:30, then we have another bathroom break, then at 8 o'clock we have breakfast. And, you know, it can feel very disorienting. And, you know, you can feel a little bit empty, a little bit, at sevens and sixes, isn't that what they say? Where you don't know what to do with yourself. And the novelty of it can be disorienting too. You know, by around day four, you're beginning to get into the groove, right? And if you're an old hand at this, if you've been coming to Sesshin for a long time, you practically don't even have, you don't have to consult the schedule. It's just you know what's coming next, and it feels comfortable because you have those energy habits, right? So this is what, according to Buddhist thinking, makes reality reality for us. You know, makes our lived reality into our lived reality. When people first get married, you know, if people who live together or get married, you know, they don't have the same vasana. They don't have the same energy habits. And they may never have the same energy habits. So for example, I get up at 5 o'clock or 5:30 and my wife goes to bed at 5:30 or close, right? Maybe a few hours earlier, you know. So we don't have the same vasana, you know. But when we first lived together, you know, we tried to have the same vasana, right? We you know, we don't both go to bed at the same time, get up at the same time, eat at the same time. And it's an adjustment, right? So, you know, because we didn't have the same life patterns, right? So you know, as we live, you know, society encourages us into these patterns of repetition. But we ourselves build our reality by creating these repetitive patterns. And we might not give much thought to this because our doing this and the patterns themselves are kind of invisible. But they create our reality. You know, when I was starting high school, I went out for track. And I was a terrible track. I was no good at track. And I wasn't a particularly good-looking guy, so I couldn't be one of the cool people in high school, right? But I realized that if I was good at school, right, studying, and getting good grades. I could get good grades, which amazed me, really, you know. But once I got good grades, I was getting strokes from my teachers for being smart. I definitely wanted to get more of those strokes. So, you know, at first it was odd after dinner to sit back down and say, start cracking the books again, right? I at first, when I was like in the ninth grade, you know, I would come home, do some homework, eat, and then my homework wouldn't be done. And I'd have to go back and say, like, do my algebra too or something, right? And I would make this a habit, you know? I would just sort of expect it after dinner, I'm going to sit down. And often I did, like, my math after dinner. And, you know, the funny thing was that I noticed that, you know, when I didn't have anything to do in the evening, when I didn't have any homework or something, I felt like uneasy. You know, in fact, in the summertime, I would even get math books and spend some time just looking. This is maybe says more about me than anything else, but I wanted to keep up. So I would get the math book, and it'd be very like comforting or reassuring to do some math problems in the evening. And then when school started, it was just, oh yeah, I'm back in reality, right? That's what is reality. It's really just this world we create with our through repetition and the vasana, right? And because they're invisible to us, it just feels like reality. But if you begin to look at your own life and you begin to look at the way you pattern your energy habits, right? The way you regularize your life and construct your life in terms of these rituals or these repetitive behaviors, you know, you realize how thoroughly your life is built out of these things, right? And living together means sort of sharing the rituals, just like coming to sit this morning on a Saturday, right? We recite the sutras. And when we recite the sutras, believe it or not, we're actually, it's like we're sharing or building together these energy habits, you know? I don't know if you've noticed, but the sutras have different tempos, right? So, you know, the some of the sutras are fast and some of them are slow. And, you know, they're actually like you're sort of like speeding up here and slowing down here. And it's like we're building this these common like energy habits, right? And even Zazen, right? I mean, Zazen is a way of repetitive behavior that creates these vasana, this sense of reality of all this. The first time you sit on, last night we had a beginner who came to sit, and I'm sure this seemed totally weird. But if you do this for a while, sitting feels completely natural, and you go through sort of like regular stages in your sitting period. So we create these structures that are invisible to us, that involve how we use our natural energy, when we are active and when we're passive. We repeat these practices until they feel real, and we inhabit this world that feels real. And one problem with this is that we become, because they're invisible and because they feel over time so comfortable, you know, we become prisoners of our vasana, right? And then we will often resist change because it feels difficult. You know, I remember being pretty much of a late morning person. You know, all through my undergraduate education, I tried to pick classes like that were after 10 o'clock. An 8 o'clock class would have been, after my first year, would have been like really unthinkable to me. So I very rarely took an 8 o'clock class. Because I'm a humanist, most of my professors didn't teach at 8 o'clock. They taught in the afternoon, right? So I was not challenged by this. But when I started doing Zen, you know, the Zen Center in Seattle had a sit at 7 in the morning. And for me, that meant getting up at 5:30, you know, getting everything ready for school, taking a shower, and then getting picked up by my friend John Sunston and going down to the Zen Center in his Volkswagen bus. And that was a shock for me. Getting up before the sun was up, you know, was a shock. And for a while, it was painful and difficult. And I would be dragged, my ass would be dragging all day. But, you know, the more I did it, gradually, I began to enjoy getting up early. And in fact, I've never stopped. You know, it was unthinkable to me. But actually, when I could rebuild myself, rebuild my vasana. And we underestimate, you know, how trapped we become in our vasana, how trapped we become in our habits, our habit and energy habits, right? And also we underestimate how flexible they are, flexible, right? So actually, you know, the Buddhist teaching is that there's nothing about ourself that is essential or unchangeable. There's no, you know, if you go to the bookstore, there are all these books about, there's still like, I'm happy to see, I was in Barnes & Noble the other day on Route 22. And I was happy to see that there was still a self-help section, and it still has a lot of books. And a lot of the premise of a lot of those books is that you have an essential self. There's a Kurt, right? And a lot of life means discovering who Kurt really is, right? Who is Kurt really? And, you know, the premise of a lot of these books is that there's a false Kurt, but there's also, you know, which is the Kurt I become in order to please others. But actually, there's a real Kurt I need to discover. And I need to discover the real Kurt by not listening to others, but trusting like my own heart or my own dreams or my own, this sounds a little bit like Zen, you know, actually, like, yeah, true nature. But you know, actually, it's not. You know, the idea that there's an essential Kurt or an essential Bill, you know, that's from the Buddhist standpoint, not true. You know, the Buddhist standpoint would be that all there is to Kurt are these energy habits, right? That's all that gives Kurt his consistency over time. And it basically, the more we repeat, the more real the habits that define us seem to be. And that this is reassuring, but you know, we can also become like prisoners of our vasana. And you know, a really good example, I was just reading this article the other day about unhappy marriages. And it was really a shocker, because it said something, you know, there's a huge number of people who stay married even though they're very unhappy, right? And the proportion was impressive and discouraging, right? I mean, you can understand why. I mean, I just read an article the other day where this woman said, if I get divorced, I don't have any health care, right? You know, so, okay, I understand that. But the article said, you know, a lot of people stay together in unhappy relationships because change feels worse. Because, you know, so they're unhappy and they're even miserable, but they stay in the relationship because it's familiar, right? And that, you know, it's like the vasana are familiar, right? And this is the same thing I used to feel in school. You know, when I played hooky and I wasn't eating lunch at 12:30 in the cafeteria, I felt uneasy and guilty and so on. But when I was in the cafeteria, I felt bored eating the, you know, terrible food in the cafeteria, and my afternoon was just an unrelenting, you know, 4 hours of sitting and listening to somebody drone on. So like, you know, basically these vasana are very powerful, and we get trapped. We can get trapped by them, right? And uncertainty is frightening, right? Uncertainty is frightening. But, you know, I think that we also need to appreciate that we have this power to transform ourselves, which we underestimate, right? We underestimate how completely different as people we can be, you know? And if you can't do it like that, but the way to transform yourself is to do new things, right? Do new things that might feel unfamiliar. And Zazen is a way of like transforming your vasana, right? So, you know, my father grew up in Newark, New Jersey during the Great Depression. And he was a city kid, right? He never had much experience of like the natural world until we were on this military base. And a friend of his asked my father if he wanted to be an assistant scoutmaster, which is something like my father would never have dreamed of doing, right? A Boy Scout leader. And one of the things the scoutmaster, who was a military guy, wanted us to do was go on a hike, like a 50-mile hike. You get a merit badge for hiking. And my father was the kind of guy who, rather than walk a block, would probably just jump in his car and drive. So we all went on this hike together, right? And my father was in acute misery in every possible way. He wasn't used to like being out in the natural world. He had never slept in a tent before, carrying a back. All this was like totally new. And he was acutely out of shape, right? It was like I could see the misery on his face. But, you know, after it was all over, you know, after we didn't make the 50 miles, as a matter of fact, I think we quit after like 20 miles or something. But after the whole event, the week was over, you know, it really transformed my father. You know, he was acutely miserable the whole time, but, you know, at the end of it, he actually liked the experience. He actually liked the experience, and he did it again and again. And he became sort of a nature boy. You know, he began to really enjoy being out in the natural world. And when I was in college, we would go on hikes together. You know, it was painful and frightening for him. And many aspects of it were completely alien. And I think that's what was so liberating for him. You know, this, it was like a different world. And he had to get up at a different time. He ran out of cigarettes, and he had, you know, had to go without cigarettes for a few days. The whole thing was a nightmare, but at the end of it, he felt so liberated. And, you know, his legs hurt when he went to bed every night because we were hiking and carrying ridiculously heavy packs. They were too heavy. The scoutmaster didn't know anything about hiking, so the packs were too heavy. But at the end of it all, it's like you realize that your life can be totally different. And you know, this, I think, is really something we underestimate, how much we can transform ourselves. And our mental habits are the same way, right? You know, lots of people engage in, like, these looping thoughts. I don't know if you have this problem, but lots of people get into these mental states they can't get out of, or they feel they can't get out of. You know, so I have these myself, right? Under certain circumstances, you know, I'll start, like, replaying these tapes in my head, right? A certain series of memories will come up, or, you know, I'll begin to enter an emotional state, like maybe a sad emotional state, or a state of feeling abandoned, let's say. Now, these are all like familiar emotional states. And, you know, doing Zazen for so many years, I can see, like, these energy, I can see, recognize, like, these familiar energy habits, you know? So if something happens to me that throws me for a loop, right? Something unexpected happens that, you know, basically I'm not prepared for and that I didn't want to have happen, right? You know, I can recognize, like, these energy habits that are ancient, right? They've been around since I'm a little kid. You know, it's like this is the same reaction I might have if they're choosing up sides for the baseball team, and I'm the last person neither side wants to pick me for their baseball team. You know, and I can remember, I might not remember that event, but those emotions are all there, right? And it can feel as though, you know, if we're not alert to this, you know, we fall right back into some of these energy habits, or if something happens to you, you know, you might rehearse that event over and over again in spite of yourself, right? If something, especially if it's painful or difficult, you know, you find yourself going over and over. These are your vasana. So, you know, the very word, you might not be aware of this, but the very word samsara, you know, in Buddhism we talk about nirvana, and we talk about samsara. Samsara and nirvana are opposites, right? And samsara means to go around and around. It means being repeating behaviors that we're unable to break free from, right? And we were in those loops. We can feel that they're unbreakable. And, you know, but they're not unbreakable. They only feel unbreakable. You know, one way to deal with being trapped in those loops is to do something else that requires concentration. So my second teacher, Webb Roshi, had a period in his life which was, I think, very challenging for him. You know, there were some things that happened to him that were, you know, painful and difficult. And, you know, at that time, Webb began to get involved with the tsado tea ceremony. I don't know if you know anything about the tea ceremony, but it's this beautiful Zen ritual that was invented by this person named Sen no Rikyu. And it involves taking powdered tea and putting it in a bowl, beautiful bowl, and whisking it with a little bamboo whisk. And there's a whole etiquette of how to put the tea in the bowl, how to pour the water, and then how to serve the tea to others, right? It's something you do with other people, generally speaking. Webb would go every week. There was a Tsago Society in Seattle, and he would go every week to the tea house in the Japanese Gardens. And he would spend like half a day doing the tea ceremony over and over again. And it's quite elaborate, you know, all the different aspects of this. But, you know, what I think he was doing, I think what tea ceremony does is to take you out of your loops, right? Your familiar loops, and restructure your energy habits. You know, so, you know, when you're doing tea ceremony, no matter how distressed you might be, after a while, your mind is going to become calm and serene and focused on the present moment. And it's, if you ever have a chance to do it, first time you do it, it's just strange. But if you keep doing it, you create the calmness you're seeking just by going through these activities, right? Just by repeating these behaviors. You know, Zazen is a little different, right? When we sit down on the cushion, you know, we confront all of our mental, all of our distractions, all of our mental habits begin to come to the surface as we're sitting. If you've had a tough day, when you come in and you sit down on the cushion, at first you might feel some relief, but then, you know, those loops start coming back. And what we do is sort of go like to, by going into Mushin, we're going to like ground zero. It's like zero energy habits, right? You're sort of like entering Mushin and everything sort of grinds to a halt. And, you know, what we do then is we sort of like rebuild our present moment from zero. And, you know, you're watching the breath, you're in emptiness. And, you know, if you're working with your koan, the koan's directing you to something, right? Or if you're just following the breath, you know, following the breath creates a different mental habit. You know, it's repetitive, and sooner or later you begin to go into deep samadhi, right? And in deep samadhi, you know, your emotional distress begins to disappear. And if you stay there long enough, you can begin to have this feeling of spaciousness or openness, right? So, you know, this is possible because we don't have an essential self, because all of those self-help books are really not correct. You know, if there were an essential self, it would be very difficult to ever change. And, you know, we behave as though there is a self, and then that we can't change. But, you know, if you already practicing Zen, you know that, you know, we all pick up these mental habits in our life that are, you know, toxic or destructive or cause us to be insensitive to others. And it's possible to feel at certain times that we'll never get out of this. We'll never get out of this. You know, I remember at one stage in my Zen training, you know, I started Zen, I think, because I felt depressed. And I didn't really know I felt depressed, but I did. And I started going to sit at the Zen Center, and I just felt better. I don't think I ever consciously said to myself, oh, I feel better. But I definitely did feel better. And that's why I kept going, even though it was difficult. You know, after a couple of years, I became more aware, actually, of like my own sort of destructive mental habits. You know, before I started Zen, I was sort of oblivious to them, right? You know, I would practice Zen, and I was oblivious to them. I would get angry, and somebody might say, "Why are you so angry?" And I'd say, "I'm not angry." That was definitely part of my character. And other things too. If people said, "Why are you down?" I'd say, "Oh, I'm not down. I'm fine." When I began to do Zen, I began to feel better, and then I began to see my vasana. And, there was a period in my Zen training where I suddenly realized I have a lot of things to overcome. I have a lot of obstacles that are in my way, that keep me in a kind of paralysis or keep me in a kind of unhappiness, right? And in that period in my training, it seemed like these were obstacles that I would never overcome, right? So I would go to Sesshin, and around day three of Sesshin, I would just feel like a complete loser, right? It would be like I'd go to Sesshin with high hopes, and everything would be going okay day one, and everything would be going okay day two, and then I would go in to see the Roshi, Genki Roshi, with my answer to my koan, and he'd bring me out. He'd say, "No, you're not there." And then I'd come back to my cushion, and I'd just feel that old feeling of like, I can't win, I can't win, which goes back to, my early life. I can't win. And, at that moment, I didn't really want to leave Sesshin, but I would spend a day or two in that place, right? I'd spend a day or two in that place. And all these negative vasana, they would come up. I can't win. I'm never going to answer my koans. I'm never, enlightenment is not attainable for me. And, fortunately, I wouldn't leave the Sesshin. I'd hang out. And, generally by the end of the Sesshin, I was in a much better place. I began to work through those habits. And working through those habits means just focusing on the moment, cleaning the toilets, if that was my job, cutting carrots, watching the breath. And, little by little, you're like rebuilding your consciousness from the ground up, right? And we all, if we practice Zen long enough, we all become, I think, more aware of our vasana, more aware of these negatives, right? And some of them last a long time, right? I mean, some of these habits are so deep, they go back to early childhood. It may take 10 years or 15 years before you say goodbye to them forever, right? And maybe some of them we never say goodbye to forever, actually, I have a range of vasana that come up when I say do sesshin, right? It used to be I'll never win vasana, but that still comes up sometime, right, in a different form. There are other vasanas too, that come up. And, we become aware of these and, we go back to ground zero. And, suddenly they go away because they're not who we really are. They're just things we've picked up in the course of our life. And, if you construct yourself, if you say to yourself, "This is who I really am, I'm a loser," or "This is who I really am, it's difficult not to do that sometime because we're so familiar with being in that place that we associate it with who we are, right? So look, one of the emotions some people have is a feeling of powerlessness, right? And, in the middle of a session, you could feel this overwhelming sense of like, I can't control anything. I'm powerless in my life. That can come up in a session or even on a sit. Right? And, it's tempting to say, this is the truth of my life. This is who I really am deep down. And you please resist that temptation. Because even the Buddha's teaching is that that's not who you really are. Those are just things that have happened to you. And if things that have happened to you, hold on to as your essential self, they do become like these very deeply ingrained habits, right? But no habit is inescapable. No habit energy can't be like unwound and dismantled. Right? And, you know, so we're sort of unwinding all these toxic habit energies in the course of our practice. And we're sort of like cultivating, you could say, virtuous habit energies, right? Virtuous habit energies. And the virtuous habit energies don't feel virtuous at first, but the more you do them, the better they feel, the more energizing and liberating they feel, right? Bonzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds, there is no Dharma. So, you know, in Buddhism, there's this concept of the loka, the worlds, right? And there are three worlds, basically. The realm of desire, right? The realm of form, and the realm of emptiness, right? So basically, you know, desire is the realm, we all know desire, right? That's the, in Buddhist thinking, there's a realm of like pure appetite. Right? There's a realm of form, which is actually like the realm of thought. Right? So there's a realm of like appetite, there's the realm of thought, and then there's mushin, right? And Bonzan says something really interesting. He doesn't say, the Buddha is your rock of ages. Cling to the Buddha and all will be well. Because that's actually not the path to liberation. What Bonzan says is there is no Dharma. There's nothing essential anywhere. There's nothing unchangeable anywhere. See, you can change your life completely. And it's because you have no essential self, you know. And this is something I think we all get trapped in these energy habits, and they feel familiar and inescapable because they become part of the story we tell ourselves about who we really are. But you know, Zen practice is all about dismantling those stories and experience and realizing we can rebuild ourselves from the ground up as, you know, compassionate, awake people. And it, there are moments in our lives where that seems unthinkable, but that's not the voice of, don't listen to that voice, right? Just begin your life again, go back to zero and watch the breath and so on. And there's a moment where everything, the whole world, your whole life starts again. And we keep returning to that moment, and little by little we become completely different people. Completely different people. Setro's verse, three worlds, no essential self. No essential anything. Where could you find the mind? The white clouds crowd the heavens. The streams draw music from the heart. Tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought the autumn waters deep.